I spoke to you. Love Talk Radio.
Welcome to CrimeWire, an elite team of veteran investigation experts along with noted crime consultants and attorneys often featured on the popular news programs for families of violent crimes to find answers and seek justice. The CrimeWire team, Vito Colucci Jr., private investigator and author, Denny Griffin, retired investigator and author, Tom Shemshak, retired chief of police and private investigator, Susan Murphy Milano, violence expert and author, are there on top of the crime at the top of their game. CrimeWire is a place for information, news, safety, and most importantly, justice. Our interactive website is www.crimewiresite.com. You may call in any time during the show. The number is 1-646-478-0982. And remember, you can participate in tonight's show simply by going to the live interactive chat right here on Blog Talk Radio. If you are a friend or a family member and you'd like to send the CrimeWire team information on an unsolved or suspicious death case that you'd like to be considered for a future segment on our show, please email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com.
In August 1972, 27-year-old Marine Sergeant William Miller returned to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, following a deployment in Okinawa. But when he arrived at the home he shared with his wife, Vicki, and Wendy, their one-year-old daughter, he found that while he was away, another Marine, George Hayden, had taken up residence in his house. Sergeant Miller gave the interloper a beating and threw him out of the home. Vicki opted to go with Hayden, packed up the baby, and moved out. Humiliated, Hayden told Miller he would get revenge with an M16. On September 16, 1972, Miller received a call from his estranged wife to meet him on Western Boulevard. Less than 20 minutes later, Miller was found dead in the street, shot twice with rounds from an M16. A few days later, Hayden showed up at the neighbor's house and took the alleged evidence Miller had been collecting against him. Detectives suspected Hayden of killing Miller, but couldn't gather sufficient evidence for an arrest. However, Sharon Aguilar, Miller's sister, refused to let the case die. She spent years compiling documents in the case and eventually turned them over to a local newspaper. The Jacksonville Daily News ran two cold case articles in the summer of 2008 that resulted in new information from a witness previously unknown to law enforcement. A whirlwind investigation by the Onslow County Sheriff's Department, Naval Criminal Intelligence Services, and the North Carolina Bureau of Investigation resulted in Hayden's arrest on first-degree murder charges. Nearly 38 years after the murder and after 3 days of deliberations, the jury convicted Hayden of first-degree murder. And on May 26, 2010, he was sentenced to life in prison. But the relief the Miller family felt at having received justice for their loved one was relatively short-lived. Hayden appealed, and on June 7, 2011, the North Carolina Appeals Court reversed the conviction, stating in its ruling, quote, "Accordingly, we hold that the state failed to present sufficient evidence from which a rational juror could conclude that defendant was the perpetrator of the victim's murder," end quote. Onslow County submitted the case to the North Carolina Supreme Court for review. On October 7th, Sharon Aguilar learned the court decided not to look at the case. George Hayden will be a free man within a matter of days. Sharon Aguilar and reporter Lindell Kay of the Jacksonville Daily News are with us tonight to discuss the case and the latest developments. And welcome, Sharon, and welcome, Lindell.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Sharon, before we get into the case itself, is Mr. Hayden still awaiting to be released, or is he actually out on the street?
The prison called me a couple days ago and said his wife would be picking him up the next day, so I assume he's out, yes.
So as far as you know, he's back, he's a free man?
Yes.
Okay, If you would, Sharon, could you tell us a little bit about your brother, obviously a Marine sergeant, and then we'll get into the specific facts of the case.
Well, my brother was a Marine, above all things. That was his goal in life, to be an officer. And he had three beautiful daughters who he loved dearly. And right before he was killed, when he shortly after he came back from Okinawa, he found out that he had been accepted into officers school at in Virginia. So his dream would have been a reality. As I said, he was very family oriented, and he loved his daughters, and he was excited about life.
I don't know where you are, but you need to come inside because it sounds like you're out in a tunnel.
That's probably me. I'm inside. I live a mile from the base, and you're going to hear them jets no matter where
okay.
we are. This is Marine territory, and we can't escape the night flights and the bombings. I mean, that's just
okay. Sharon, can I ask you when he was married? I mean, did you know that they have a good relationship that you knew of?
Well, Vicki, I only met her once. He brought her to I was living in Madison at the time. He brought her to Madison, and I wasn't impressed at all. He had told me she was a go-go dancer, which...
Does that mean stripper back then?
I don't know. I don't even want to know what it was, yeah. And she was like a little mouse. She didn't say very much, and I was surprised that he even was having a relationship with her. The family only met her, you know, as I said, once, I think. I know my sister Bonnie went down to Jacksonville there, right, and stayed overnight with them in their trailer right before he went to Okinawa. So she was the last to see him before he went to Okinawa.
And Sharon, my understanding is that Vicki and Hayden actually had known each other prior. They were from the same place in Ohio or something?
Yeah, I understood that they were like high school sweethearts.
Okay, so they had a past relationship.
Yes, yes.
Yeah. Okay. And after your brother was killed that night, after this came down where he returned from Okinawa, got in the dispute with Mr. Hayden at the house and threw him out and so forth, and then he was killed with rounds from an M16 a short time later. And your brother, in the interim, had found out that Mr. Hayden not only had moved into his home, but he had actually was using and signing your brother's name to checks and so forth. Is that true?
Yes, yes. Identity theft back then was kind of unknown. It wasn't unknown, but it wasn't like it is today with the Internet and so forth. But, yes, it was identity theft.
And he was gathering evidence against Mr. Hayden for the fraud issue. Plus, he was I assume building some type of a matrimonial action against Vicki.
Yes,
and he was
yes.
giving this information to a next door neighbor for safekeeping. Is that the way it worked?
Yeah, he was also wanted to get full custody of Wendy.
Okay.
So he had spoke to somebody about all three of those items.
Do you think that George Hayden and Vicki were aware that he was gathering this evidence or gathering information of possible maybe filing criminal charges against Hayden for any fraud?
Well, I can't answer that, although I assume it, because George then, after Billy was dead, he approached the neighbor to get the information, so he had to know.
Okay, and then nothing was done at that time. I guess Hayden was a suspect. He was a what they call today, I guess, a person of interest, but there was insufficient information, so Hayden went about his life and with Vicki. And Hayden then became a police chief. Is that true in a couple of different jurisdictions there?
Yeah. He retired from the Marines, and then he became a police officer and eventually a police chief. Now, I can't even imagine how somebody with background became a police chief. It's just beyond me.
What do you mean background?
Well, being a suspect in a murder.
But he wasn't officially a suspect, so he could still go about doing his...
All the documents pointed to him, and I question it, yes.
Lindell, when did you first get involved with this case? Had you heard about it when it happened, or just when did you take an interest?
I was not even born when it happened, sir.
Okay.
The newspaper began to write a series of cold case articles here in Jacksonville with the Marine Corps. It'll be at any base. I mean, anywhere you had a transient population, military population, there's a lot of unsolved crimes, you know, people coming in and out of the area. So we took a crack at some of them, and we had some small success with some cases being reopened and whatnot. And Bill Miller was just a name on a list that was handed to me, and we were working on it, and Sharon contacted me. She was looking through the internet. She found my name and our website, and she contacted me. And I can tell you that of the 25, 30 unsolved murders that I've written about, no one had near the amount of information that Sharon had. And she had spent almost 40 years gathering that information meticulously. I mean, we're talking back when it was, she had to write a letter and ask for it and wait months for a response and back and forth like that. I mean, she had gathered information over a long period of time, and every bit of it pointed to George Hayden. And so when we began to run those newspaper stories, that's when a witness, a woman that used to babysit Bill's daughter when, you know, and at that time, Bill and Vicky's daughter, she came forward with some information about another witness. Police investigators went and interviewed that witness up in Chicago, and that's when they came back, and George was arrested, you know, very shortly after that.
And I remember it. I mean, there was some... programs that are no longer, but there was a lot of us, including myself, we covered this because it was a cold case that had gotten cracked. We were so proud of Sharon, who had been so diligent, you for writing the stories on this, and that there was justice finally coming. And
right. I remember being on your show at that time, and it was a sense of closure.
Well, an accomplishment,
for
you know, because you don't
right.
see this that often, and we had said that what Sharon had done, which we had wanted to see a lot of families do, is don't give up, persist, find answers, put it together. So that's what she does. And,
yes,
and then
for 40 years, she kept the information. I mean, she gathered information. She had, as a matter of fact, she had information that the local investigators were completely unaware of. I mean, she had information that she had gotten from the Marine Corps that the detectives here that had worked on the case sporadically over the years, they had no idea even existed. So, you know, I mean, she had certainly done her homework on that, and I think that's why it's especially heartbreaking for her and for the family, you know, for her to have put so much work into this. I got another airplane going over the house. The rent is really cheap, but you got to live with that. God bless America. But she had put so much work into to this case, to have it unravel at the last minute is really a shame. Because I mean, the prosecutors, they took a shot. They really poured this this case into a bottle that the jury believed. And I think the appeals court shocked a lot of people by simply saying, well, we don't think they should have found him guilty.
Do you think it's because of what his career was, what he did for a living, that they just didn't want to believe it? The case was old in their mind?
No, I mean, they said that there was never a murder weapon found, and, you know, there was some other – the case was circumstantial.
Well, they couldn't
put
it
on. But, I mean, what's wrong with circumstantial cases? You know, I mean, especially when you're dealing with a 40-year-old case, most of your evidence is going to be circumstantial. And I just – I don't really understand the prosecutor – that prosecuted the case. I mean, he's been doing this for many, many years, and he's heartbroken over it too. He doesn't understand. I mean, this was a major victory for them, and also a chance to give the Millers something that they've been denied for so long, and then to have the appeals court. I mean, no one saw this coming. This was something. I remember his trial attorney, Billy Joe Morgan, was telling me that it was going to get overturned, and of course, they, you know, defense attorneys say that a lot. But no one, I mean, I could sit with it better if it was overturned because the prosecutors made a mistake, or, you know, this piece of evidence was found inadmissible, or, you know, some sort of legality. But just for the appeals court to say we don't think the jury would have made this decision or should have made this decision, that's really hard for a lot of people to comprehend.
Now, the person that he was married to at the time, for everybody that's listening, what happened to Vicky?
She was they married 4 months after Bill died. They got married 4 months, and then they were together for a while. Then they got divorced, but they stayed close over
the
years. They shared children. Yeah, they had a child together. But she was arrested also and charged with first-degree murder. And the after Bill's conviction, after George Hayden's conviction, the state dropped charges against her.
And so I think she's out walking free.
Well, yeah, exactly. And I think the feeling there was that they had the shooter. I know that a lot of people would have rather seen or would really like to see Vicky in prison. But I think the state felt like, you know, we've got the guy who actually pulled the trigger. We need to, you know, cut and run while we can, or you know, not risk, you know, not go out on a limb with this trial with her. But then seeing how this one turned out, I mean, I don't know. I'm shocked. I mean, I've been doing this about 7 years. I work with people who've been doing it a lot longer than that. The prosecutor's been doing it 40 years, and no one has ever seen the appeals court say the jury should not have made that choice without any, you know, not that evidence was inadmissible or that a witness was incorrect. You know, no reason for the reversal other than exactly like you read at the top of the show to say that the jury shouldn't have made that choice.
Well, didn't the prosecutor go in on the appeal? Did he answer when the defense had appealed this case?
Absolutely, and this was one of the – in North Carolina, appeals are usually just on paper. You write a brief and you turn it in, both sides turn it in, and the judges read it and they make a decision. This was one of the few cases in recent history where both sides got up and argued the case. And the North Carolina Attorney General's office, they argued for 30 minutes. Both sides argued for 30 minutes on this case. And then the judges, you know, they took the case. And then when they appealed it, the U.S. Attorney's Office on behalf of the Onslow County District Attorney's Office, they again asked the Supreme Court, to the North Carolina Supreme Court, to look at this case to see if they agree with the decision of the appeals court. And when the Supreme Court declined to look at it, that pretty much left the appeals decision standing, which I know for Sharon, I talked to her just moments after the prosecutor told her that what had happened, and I know, you know, I mean, I've talked to her a lot over the years, and this is something that it's really not fair, I don't think. I've been trying to, as a journalist, I've been trying to keep my objectivity here, but I mean, I think, I'm sure there'll be an editorial in the paper, not written by me, but written by my editors, to say that this was a completely this was just a travesty of justice. And I don't mean to. Go ahead.
Does he get everything then restored? You know, pension, all that stuff. Does he then, you know, become an upstanding citizen, and this just all goes away?
I don't know. Certainly in the community's eyes, that probably won't ever happen. I mean, I think the community is convinced of his guilt, and his law enforcement days are over, I'm sure.
He's too old anyway.
Well, I mean, he was right up until the same year that he was arrested. He had gotten dismissed for something unrelated. So I mean, he was still working as a police chief at that age, or at the age he was in 2008. But I mean, his son is a police officer in a local town here. I mean, he's a good kid from everybody that I talked to and everything. I mean, it was a thing. This is something that George, I was getting comfortable saying that he did it, because, you know, as in journalism, once the jury says he did it, then we can go ahead and say that without any sort of libel issues. But now I don't know where I'm at with the appeals decision. But I mean, this is something that most people agree that he did, and most people can see it clearly. And he more or less didn't have to answer for it for 40 years. And then it looked like there was finally going to be some justice for the Miller family, and then they got the rug pulled out from under them. And I know it's frustrating for them. They're a close family, but they're spread out all over the United States, and they came here for the trial. Lasted 2 or 3 weeks. Every one of them was here, all his brothers and sisters. I mean, it was something that it really felt like something was done right at the trial, and I think it felt good for a lot of people, you know. And then this just kind of is a real punch in the gut to the community, I think, and to the cops and the prosecutors that worked on it. I mean, they put a lot of time. NCIS put years into this case. They were investigating it when no one else even knew that they were. You know, so I mean, it's a rough thing. And for me personally, you know, I mean, it's the cold case thing, we accomplished a little bit, but I mean, certainly that was our best achievement to see George locked up. And I believe George was guilty. I mean, the evidence, I mean, it was there. The circumstantial evidence is undeniable. And just like the prosecutor told me that we reported in the newspaper, that a jury convicted him beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no doubt in the jury's mind. And they sit there and they sifted through. Sharon can tell you, I mean, there was witness after witness after witness after witness. They dug. They found witnesses that I didn't even know were alive. I mean, they went and they found witnesses all over the United States to come testify at this trial. And it just seems like they got shortchanged by the appeals court.
Susan, can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, I was disconnected. I managed to get back on. You know, we were talking a little bit just before the show started, and I was asking Lindell if the prosecutor's office had made an official statement yet, and I don't think he got to answer that question.
I was just talking about that. I'll go ahead and say it again. I talked to the district attorney, Ernie Lee. He prosecuted the case prior to being elected to the office. He's been a prosecutor for 30-something years, a long time he's been a prosecutor. He's tried 100 murder cases. He's only lost two. He was extremely upset with the Supreme Court and obviously with the appeals court for their decision. And I think he's a little dumbfounded by it. He's a little befuddled by the fact that the appeals court could just say, well, we don't think the jury would do that. We don't think the jury should have done that. I mean, it's a...
You know, let me ask you this. You know, based on that the quote I read at the top of the show about the from the appeals court, that a rational juror could not or should not have found him guilty. That means the 12 jurors, at least in the opinion of the appeals court, were irrational. And I'm assuming that this Hayden's trial, like virtually every trial, at the end, before the case went to the jury, that the defense probably filed a motion for dismissal based on the fact there was insufficient evidence.
Absolutely.
And the judge apparently ruled against the defense. So not only the appeals court opinion is accurate, the 12 jurors plus the judge were all arrested.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, remember, circumstantial evidence, I mean, is the appeals court saying that it's never valid? I mean, if so, you know, there should be all kinds of prisoners released. But remember Scott Peterson case? He was convicted and given death sentence when there was no weapon found. He wasn't that placed at the scene of the crime. And these are the two things that they're saying they're overturning our case for.
I mean, I was always taught in my dealings with prosecutors and with defense attorneys, circumstantial evidence, you know, regardless of what you see on TV or whatever, circumstantial evidence is just as valid and just as strong as physical evidence. And in a lot of cases, it can show you what physical evidence can. You know, physical evidence can show you that a man shot a man with a gun, but only circumstantial evidence can tell you why he did it. And I think that with the appeals court saying what's going to come out of this is not only are the Millers robbed of some justice, I think, but future cases are not going to be looked at for possible prosecution, especially cold cases. Because
exactly.
When you've got a case that's 40 years old, all you've got is circumstantial evidence. I mean, there's always that hope that the DNA comes through, you know, that kind of situation. But, I mean, when you're dealing with a case like that, well, the only possible way it could be solved is if for a witness to come forward and say, I saw what happened. You know, and then when that's thrown out and when the appeals court says that they're irrational for finding someone guilty based on that, there's a lot of cold cases that are in jeopardy.
They gave their time and everything connected with this. You know, it's going to make people think twice about serving on a jury.
Sure. We interviewed a lot of the jurors after the case, and I remember one gentleman very specifically. He was very articulated. He was very intelligent. We sat down on his back porch for 2 hours talking about the case, and he went through and he walked me through each thing and each process and at what point that he was convinced of George Hayden's guilt. And I don't think that man is irrational. I think that man was highly rational and very intelligent and very articulate in what he believed and what he was convinced of by the prosecutors. And, you know, and Hayden had a very good defense. I mean, Billy Joe Morgan, he's one of the oldest, best defense attorneys in our area, and he put on a really good defense. And I'm really shocked about the appeals court. That is something out of left field for me.
And now this case now is over, right? I mean, there's nowhere else to go.
That's it.
Yes.
And he can't be recharged. He's got, you know, the double jeopardy and all this, so.
That's right.
But she can.
Vicky could be, yeah.
Vicky could be charged with something.
Yes, she could, yes.
And the children, I mean, what about his children? They're all grown now. Have they been involved in any of this process?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't know about George's son, but Vicky, he didn't show up at the trial at all.
Okay.
Billy's daughter, Wendy, who Vicky is her mother, she has been with and fighting tooth and nail right with the Miller family all the way.
Okay. So that's a lot. We are out of time, and you know, Denny, I'm just wondering how this is going to affect cold cases across the country.
You know, Susan, I want to say here, you know, we deal week after week with families who are seeking justice, who have been denied justice, some obviously for a lot shorter periods of time than in the case of the Miller family. But when you finally get this breakthrough after 38 years and get a conviction and think you've won justice for your loved one. And then to have this happen, I mean, it's just devastating. And, God, I just can't imagine it. And, you know, I'm supporter of the law, and I know this is the system and so on and so forth. But even having said that, it's tough to see how this could happen and that these three guys and these three judges and the Court of Appeals were right and the 12 jurors and the trial judge were all irrational. It just it's very troublesome to me, and I don't know what else, you know.
Thank you both. We are out of time.
Okay, thank you so much
for telling
our story.
Thank you, guys.
You know, it's very sad. I mean, it's just, it continues to be so, and I just, I'm boggled by this. Let's bring on our next case. Our next case is the Alicia Carver case. It's September 11th, 2002. 19-year-old Alicia Carver was beaten to death in a residence located at 218 Lake Street in Nulano, Louisiana. Alicia was residing there with her boyfriend, his 15-year-old sister, and his mother and her boyfriend. At approximately 11:05 p.m. that night, the mother returned home and found both girls badly beaten. She summoned authorities, and when police arrived, they found Alicia deceased and the 15-year-old in critical condition. She arrived but had suffered such extreme head injuries that she was unable to assist in the investigation. Alicia's boyfriend is confirmed to have been at work at the time, and the mother's boyfriend, though, was in the house, and he stated that he passed out from drinking and slept through whatever had happened. The police have a person of interest in the case, but no one has thus been far arrested. Dee Cryer, Alicia's aunt, Jean Cervantes of Citizens Against Homicide, and Detective Marvin Hilton with the Vernon Parish Sheriff's Office are here this evening to talk about the case. Welcome, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dee, let's just start with you. Tell us about Alicia. Tell us about your daughter, or your aunt, or your niece.
My niece. Alicia, she grew up a happy child. She was raised with a single parent. It was just her mother, and her sister. Eventually, like most teenagers, she became a little rebellious in her teenage years and married young, moved out of the home, got involved with some wrong people at times. It was just an unfortunate that this had to happen. The family's concern is we just want some closure in bringing someone to justice for Alicia.
So she was married at the time?
She was married but legally separated from her husband at the time.
And what about, did she have kids?
No children are involved.
And then the other, her sister was hurt as well, correct?
No, that was her boyfriend's sister.
Okay. And so she wasn't any help, and they were found, and the funeral took place. And then from there, what happened? I mean, what did you suspect? Somebody that she was dating or somebody she was involved with?
From there, I'd have to really turn it over to Detective...
No, that's not what I'm not asking you that. No.
Oh,
I'm saying,
we don't think that it's anyone that she was dating, no.
Okay, that's what I meant.
I don't believe it was anyone that she was dating.
Okay, you know, in a lot of these cases, sometimes it's somebody that maybe... You know, she's ended the relationship or, separated, and it's something that she was saying, that's all. Okay.
Yeah, no, that wasn't the case here.
Okay.
Her husband that she was separated from, I mean, it was an amicable. I mean, they were young teenagers when they got married, you know.
Did she work at the time?
No, she did not work at all. She just stayed at home. Again, she was 19 years old. You know, she's just a young teenager still figuring out what to do with her life and where to go with it.
Okay. Detective Margaret Hilton, thank you, sir, for being on here. And you were the original investigator. You have been the original investigator on this case?
Yes, ma'am. That's correct.
Sir, these kind of cases... Just in general, you know, because a lot of times we have families who
when a case goes cold, when they don't have answers, when a case is open, a department such as yourself continues to work on it, doesn't it?
Yes, ma'am, that's correct.
And people have a misconception of really what your job is, just as law enforcement, and how difficult these cases can be.
That's correct, ma'am.
And so in investigating this case, is it for the beatings to have taken place by two individuals, did you find things that were suspicious or unusual in this type of a crime where you didn't really have anybody or anything to go on at the time?
Well, in this particular case, there was a lot of traffic that was in and out of this residence and back and forth to this residence. And we've interviewed multiple individuals in reference to the case. And the problem was that there were so many different persons that came back and forth and had a lot of dealings at this particular residence. And that in itself caused the investigation a great deal of difficulty.
Detective Denny Griffin here, and I just wondered, I'm not familiar with Louisiana. I was in New Orleans once, but I'm not familiar other than that. Could you describe for us a little bit about Nulano, Louisiana, and Vernon Parish and so forth? What, how big is it? What's the population like? Is it, rural or big city or what?
It's a rural parish. We're in the west central part of Louisiana. Probably you would be more familiar with, there's a large lake in our area. It's known as Toledo Bend Lake. Like I said, we're in the west central part of Louisiana. There's approximately 50,000 people in this particular parish, but it is a rural parish. Leesville is the largest town in this particular parish, and Nulano is just a small town to the south, on the south end of Leesville. There is a police department in Nulano, which is a small police department, and mainly they deal with traffic and misdemeanor situations. We, as the sheriff's office, handle the outside of the Leesville city limits. We handle all the major investigations and that type of thing in the parish, and also assist the smaller towns.
Okay, so Nulano itself, or the where the murder took place, is that what's it like crime wise? Is it a high crime area? Is it average, below average, or how would you describe it?
As far as in our parish, it's probably one of the higher crime areas, and that's not to say that it's a bad area. It's just one of the areas where there's more population there than, say, in the other rural areas of our parish, and so therefore you do have more activity there.
And what types of crimes is there? Something that's prevalent, or is it all types of stuff, or specific areas that you have a lot of incidents in?
Well, certainly, and this is one of these situations where we do have a narcotics or illegal drug problem in the area, and there are petty thefts and that type of thing. They're probably the worst crimes that we probably deal with on a regular basis is illegal drugs.
Okay, and Gene Cervantes.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks for being with us, Gene. And for those who aren't familiar with Citizens Against Homicide, can you just take just a second and tell the listeners what the Citizens Against Homicide is all about?
We're a victim advocacy group based in California. We offer our services throughout the United States, however, and we are a specific crime, I guess, would be homicide, murder. And the co-victims, the families of murder victims, are the people that reach out to us for assistance. And we do what we can concentrate on publicity to bring the case to the public eye and to keep it in the public eye.
And that's really important in all of these cases. I mean, that's why people don't realize when they don't get the results that they want, that they got more than they would have if they do reach out to agencies such as yours. And that's part of the problem with these, too, because people don't know where to go. They don't know who to trust. And in, especially in these cold cases, it's so important to get a hold of an agency that also deals with law enforcement and has a trust of them, doesn't it, Gene?
Absolutely.
And is there a reward in this case at all? Has anybody put up a reward for information?
Crime Stoppers have a $1,000 reward.
Okay. Can I ask the detective? Was the house broken into? Was it in disarray? Was it anything out of the ordinary when you arrived to make it seem like it was something that is a break in for drugs, crime of that type, perhaps?
The mother of the younger victim, Ms. Sheila Ivey, was at a bingo. She had went to bingo, and she arrived back there at approximately 11 p.m. that night, and she is actually the person that discovered the crime. The house was in disarray, but it wasn't from a forced entry into the house.
Okay, so it had to be somebody that knew somebody. And on the street where the house was at 218 there, is it a heavily trafficked area, like off a main drag? Maybe there's a drive-in next to it or something?
It is a residential location. There are, there are several homes around that particular residence where this crime occurred. The problem being that at 11 o'clock at night, most people are already in their homes and have their doors closed, and you do have traffic up and down those streets, but they're not well lighted, and of course, there's not a lot of attention paid to that, and then you have multiple traffic that is in and out, stopping very quickly and then leaving, that type of traffic, and unfortunately, not a lot of attention is paid to that type of traffic in that area.
So nobody may have called in a 911 disturbance prior to the girls being found?
No, ma'am. We didn't have anything like that called in.
And there was somebody else inside the home.
That is correct.
Who allegedly passed out and didn't hear anything.
Yes, ma'am. That's correct.
Okay. These are my least favorite, because I just, all I do is intimate partners, and I'm the team specialist.
Yes, ma'am.
It's very difficult for me when somebody was sleeping.
Believe you me, it was difficult for us too.
But Alicia did call 911 that night.
But we're saying that other people prior to, a lot of times, you look at weather conditions, you look at traffic, you look at the area, you look at the time of night, you look at location of where this is. And it's still nice out. The windows would be open unless it was hot so that the air would be on. Somebody would have heard something. And depending on what night it is, if it's more towards the weekend, then people might be out. So that's what I was asking. So what caught my attention right away was that somebody was there who claims to have been passed out from drinking. I don't know that there's that amount of booze, unless you're taking booze with pills, that would pass it out so that you wouldn't wake up. It's just, I've got a lot of unsolved this way, and it just seems very strange to me.
Yes, ma'am. That particular person was the boyfriend of Sheila Ivey, who is the mother of the younger person that was beaten. And he was in, according to him, he was in an opposite room from where this incident occurred. And he was highly intoxicated when we arrived there.
And I'm sure he would make himself intoxicated when somebody arrived.
Yes, ma'am. And there again, we interviewed. We had the individual polygraphed and all those things. And certainly, I have a hard time believing I could sleep through some of that. But they live a different lifestyle is all I can say about that type.
But you would have had, I guess, in my opinion, you would have some, I guess it depends on his alcohol level. And, yeah, when you drink that much, you're gonna pass a polygraph because you will not remember. So that's really good for that. But the incidents is before that, you would have heard some kind of a scream. Some kind, you know, you've got two girls. They're going to scream. They're going to run.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
And so you have to hear the noise. Go ahead,
I would think so.
I was just wondering, Detective, do you, if you can tell us, I know there are certain things you don't want to say, but if you are comfortable, I was just wondering, were there signs or evidence of a struggle or a fight? Were there either of the girls or both of them maybe resisted or fought back or tried to escape or that type of thing?
There was signs of a struggle, certainly in the room where this incident occurred. There wasn't any signs of anything outside of that particular room. Where this happened was in a bedroom in this particular residence, and all of the struggle took place inside that particular bedroom and not in other areas of the residence. And both of the victims did have marks on their hands and their arms where they were trying to defend themselves.
And so the person that pretty much drank too much, did he hurt himself falling down?
No, he had no signs of having been involved in any type of struggle on him. He didn't have any type of bruises or marks on him or anything like that.
Was there, Detective, if you can say, was there any evidence that if this was just something with fists and feet or something, this beating or the beatings, or was there any evidence of some type of weapon or instrument or no?
There was evidence of a foreign object, yes.
Okay.
So then you wouldn't have exit wounds on yourself or defense wounds on yourself if that were the case, right?
That depends. You know, they were.
It depends on if you have mittens on your hands and you do certain things. I guess I can't comprehend how you can, with the struggle that's going on there. You've got, how tall are both the girls?
Allie was approximately 5 feet tall, and
right.
The other girl was maybe just an inch or two shorter.
Okay, and the person that happened to be in the home, was he over 6 foot? Was he a big guy?
No, ma'am. He was approximately 5'6", 5'7", weighed maybe 135 to 140 pounds.
Okay. Wow.
Is there any chance, Detective, that there were two perpetrators? You think it was one individual, or can't you tell at all?
That's undetermined at this time, sir.
Okay. Wow.
Was there anything with, I mean, not that this happened, I mean, she's legally separated. She's living there. And it's amazing to me, the 15-year-old, she to this day, she recalls nothing. The injuries were that severe?
We've interviewed that victim on several different occasions. We interviewed her just right after the incident occurred. We did receive information that we followed up from her on this situation. We go back and we interview her again. She told a different version of what happened.
Do you think that it's because her sister or the other girls gone, and she knows, and she perhaps in some way was intimidated or threatened just for her own life that she couldn't participate in cooperation, perhaps?
No, ma'am. I really believe that the injuries that she sustained caused her a lapse of memory, and perhaps she blocked out what happened. We have interviewed her on several different occasions, and just recently her again.
Did she have a lot of trauma to the head?
Yes, ma'am.
Mm-hmm. Okay, wow. So, and was she supposed to have lived? I mean, did it look like they were both beaten so that they wouldn't survive?
When this first occurred, of course, and those situations, they sometimes look worse than what they are. But on this particular incident, certainly the younger of the two wasn't expected to survive either. She has metal plates in her head from this, and she was brutally beaten, just like Allie was, and she just survived in spite of that.
Was it just the beatings, or was there any other assault type to their body?
Just the beatings.
And you've ruled out other people that are known to the 19-year-old, to Alicia?
We have interviewed, as I said before, a large number of people in reference to this. We do have a person of interest in this particular case. However, we've been unable to this point to develop enough evidence in order to have enough to make an arrest.
Are they
still
an official
working
person
on that,
of interest? Are they officially a person of interest?
Yes.
And so they're aware that they're a person of interest?
Do what now?
He's aware that he is a person of interest?
He absolutely is.
Okay, because, we get them. They come on the show. They look as they're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
So I just thought maybe I'd ask, because I just wanted to know if he was aware he was a person of interest. We always say that the persons involved want to know what we're going to say or what we're not going to say. And it has solved a few cases in the past, because you always somehow consciously vomit somewhere along the line in your actions and your words and what you do. And it's just interesting that this person showed up on the show today. That says a lot to me. It doesn't mean anything, but it says a lot. Is there a relationship to him directly to both of the girls or that household?
Yes, there was a connection.
Is it a public connection that's known to people or no?
No.
Okay, that's good. That's fine. That's fine. This is not what's my line. I just wanted to ask. Go ahead, Denny.
Gene, I was just wondering, Gene, what can citizens against homicide do in a situation that we're talking about here? I know you mentioned that the publicity and trying to keep the case in the public eye and so forth are one thing. Is there something citizens against homicide can do to help me out or help the police out?
Well, what we want to do is, and I will be contacting D as well as Detective Hilton, but with the $1,000 reward, I want to look into a possible billboard. A higher reward, of course, would be desirable, but we could go with the $1,000. And then what I will be doing after we start putting that little template together, my wife does that, I'll be calling Detective Hilton for possible ideal location. After we complete contact with our sources for specifics, billboard sources for specifics, such as cost versus donation, et cetera. And Citizens Against Homicide, if there is a cost, would pick up half, and the family is asked to pick up the other half.
Can I ask the detective, is this person of interest, is he married?
No.
Is he in a relationship?
No.
Does he have children?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
Is he of dating age?
Oh, yes.
Okay, so if he's listening, or those people that they also will listen in the after broadcast, this is very serious, isn't it? I mean, even though it's not been made public, at some point somebody does know the surrounding people or the surrounding individuals close to this person do know what's going on, and you would think that they would assist you. Has that happened at all?
Not at this time, no, ma'am.
You know, speaking of which, Detective, as Susan was saying, we have live listeners, plus the shows are archived within a half hour after we conclude, and people listen to them forever, basically.
The killer usually does.
I would like to make sure, if you would, give us information to the listeners about what they should do if they do have information. Who do you want them to call, and what phone number, and so forth?
Certainly. I would ask that they would call the Vernon Parish Sheriff's Department here in Leesville, Louisiana. Our phone number is 337-238-1311, and we also have an 800 number, which is 256-1534, or they can call Crime Stoppers, which is 337-239-2233. And they can ask for myself, Marvin Hilton, or Detective Ray Ortiz.
Also, the family has set up websites. We've set up
www.memoryoffelicia.webs.com.
That also has the Vernon Parish Sheriff's Department phone number and the 800 number also listed on that.
And I'd like to say, I'm not trying to speak for Detective Hilton, but generally speaking, I always make this statement. You may know something that you don't know you know. And what you need to do, if you have information or might have information, you call the police, tell them what you have, what you know. They will determine whether or not it's important. So don't just sit on it. If you have anything, something you saw, something you heard, whatever it is, make the call. Let the professional police officer talk with you. They will elicit the information from you and make a determination on where it fits, if at all, into their investigation. But if you don't make the call, you're not going to help at all.
Yeah,
right, and the family also has that also on their on the website for her, also a Facebook page for Alicia, and also an open Facebook page of Who Killed Alicia. We update it at least once a week, if not more. We're always asking if you hear anything, have heard anything, know of anyone who has heard anything, to please contact the Vernon Parish Police Department. A lot of people don't realize that they may have heard one little thing while they were out and about with friends that could open this whole case up for the police department.
And the girls are young enough where, too, you've got people talking. Somebody
right.
knew them, they're immediate friends, they know something, they hear something, and they all talk, and yet they don't feel that whatever they do or don't know, it's significant. And the one thing that people should know that they're listening is that no matter what, anytime you call, it doesn't come back to you. The person won't know that you said something, you provided information. And that's the most important, that a tip is confidential, so that when you see that information out there, and that's what they say, that's what it means. You can't be charged, you can't be arrested for providing a tip, and your safety is not compromised because it's anonymous. And I think, Denny, that we always try to say people have to pay attention and just step forward, because this child, teenager, deserves justice.
Yeah, and quite right, Susan. I just want to ask the detective, I'm just recalling his earlier comments about the area, and that at 11 o'clock-ish at night, most of the residents were probably inside with the doors locked, but there still is a lot of traffic in the area, and I think I know what that means. If somebody who was perhaps in that area, you know, a non-resident who was in there for various reasons, you know, in and out and that type of thing, and maybe know something but is afraid to call because then they would be, out of fear, they'd be asked, well, what was your business in that area that night? Would that be an issue, or would you still want to talk to them and not be hung up on why they were perhaps in the area?
No, we would be more than willing to talk with them, and you know, we can give them anonymity in reference to that. I mean, they can remain anonymous as long as they would cooperate with us in something as serious as this is.
Thank
okay,
you, Dee
great.
Carver. We're out of time. Gene Cervani, Citizens Against Homicide, Detective Marvin Hilton of the Vernon Parish Sheriff's Office. We will keep everybody updated. Thank you to our Crime Wire team, our Director of Research, Kim Colton, and Public Relations team at ImaginePublicity.com. Our next show will be a special show on Intimate Partner Violence, October 16th at 8 p.m. for the hour. And then again, we come back on Tuesday, October 18th for a regularly scheduled Tuesday night. So tune in as we continue to analyze cases, crimes that interrupt and wreak havoc on families looking for answers and seeking justice.
Thank you for joining us today on Crime Wire. We always welcome your support and value you as our guest. If you would like your case to be featured on Crime Wire, email us at thecrimewire@gmail.com. And you can hear a rebroadcast of tonight's show by going to www.crimewire.blogspot.com. Turn on the volume at your computer, and the show will automatically play. And please join Andrew DiDonato and I tomorrow night for a special edition of Mob Talk. And our guest will be former Chicago Outfit and Las Vegas mobster Frank Collada. Remember, we ensure your voices will be heard when there's nowhere else to turn. Visit our website at www.crimewiresite.com. God bless from the Crime Wire team, Vito Colucci Jr., Denny Griffin, Tom Shamshak, and Susan Murphy Milano. Thank you very much, and good night.
Thank you, everybody. Good night.
Thank you.
Good night, everybody.